From NPR News, this is Foreign Dispatch, a weekly roundup of some of the best coverage of news and events filed by NPR correspondents around the globe. I'm Douglas Roberts. On the podcast this week, reading the political tea leaves from Iran, the dangers of trucking in Pakistan, child trafficking in post-earthquake Haiti, and grieving for the dead there, too. And ABBA storms London. The political puzzle that is Iran has turned even more complex. Leaders of the opposition have made statements recently that suggest, at least to some, that they might be willing to strike a compromise with the hardline government. But just whom they would make a deal with is difficult to say. The government remains intransigent, even as more street demonstrations are anticipated next week, on the anniversary of the Islamic Revolution. NPR's Mike Schuster has more.
Things got a little baffling recently when Mehdi Karoubi, one of the leaders of the Green Movement, as the political opposition in Iran has come to be known, said in a published interview that he recognized Mahmoud Ahmadinejad as the functioning president of Iran. In subsequent comments, Karoubi tried to clarify that he did not mean to say that Ahmadinejad was the legitimate president. He said he still believes the election last June that gave Ahmadinejad a second term was fraudulent. But because Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, had declared Ahmadinejad the winner, Karoubi had to accept that as a fait accompli. For Nader Hashemi, who teaches Middle East and Islamic politics at the University of Denver, comments like this, perhaps confusing, haven't changed anything. The leaders of the movement, like Karoubi, continue to work within Iran's current constitution.
All of them remain loyal to the Islamic Republican system, but of course emphasizing the more democratic and humanistic elements of that legacy and of that political theology.
Mir Hossein Mousavi, the candidate whom the opposition believes really won the election last June, recently posted his demands on his website. They include freeing political prisoners, permitting nonviolent demonstrations, and the establishment of an impartial commission to run elections. But he too repeated his commitment to the Islamic Republic's constitution, says Nader Hashemi.
There is a sense that he still is hoping that perhaps the senior clerical leadership can come together and meet the demands of the people, particularly calling for free and fair election and allowing for greater freedom of expression for the opposition.
All of this has given rise to speculation both in and outside Iran that the strength of the opposition may be slipping and that some deal with the government may be in the works. Abbas Milani, director of Iran studies at Stanford University, doesn't see it that way.
I think there might be discussions, but I don't think the discussions are a sign of the weakness of the opposition. In fact, I think they're the signs of the weakness of the regime.
On the surface, none of Iran's hardline leaders seems ready for compromise. Last week, Iran executed two young men it said participated in street demonstrations. At Friday prayers last week, Ayatollah Ahmed Jannati, a prominent hardliner, praised the head of Iran's judiciary for carrying out the two executions and called on him to hang more demonstrators. For God's sake, carry on acting like a man, Jannati said, as you did when you executed these two individuals quickly, and we thank you for that. Wherever we failed, it was because we showed signs of weakness. If you show further weakness, an even worse future will be ahead of you. Jannati called those who demonstrated against Iran's government Mohareb, or enemies of God, a comment that left Abbas Milani nearly speechless.
It is remarkable, I think, for a regime in 21st century to get away with saying that we will consider any peaceful demonstrator as a Mohareb, an enemy of God, and we will execute them. It is just, I can't tell you how shocking that is for me to believe that a regime can say this in 21st century and get away with it.
Many fear that Iran's government will hang several other protesters before the anniversary of the Islamic Revolution next week, this in order to discourage opposition protests. Hamid Dabashi, an Iran analyst at Columbia University, says regardless of the confusion surrounding the comments of its leaders, the Green Movement will continue to present a serious challenge to Iran's government.
It has never faced such widespread popular unrest and popular uprising that it has to mobilize all its resources, security apparatus, or even organize and manufacture demonstrations in order to stay in power.
Both the opposition and the government are trying to mobilize large numbers for the anniversary of the revolution on February 11th. Mike Schuster, NPR News.
In the past year, there have been some 40 attacks on NATO supply trucks en route from Pakistan to Afghanistan, two of them just last week. At the port city of Karachi, NPR's Julie McCarthy climbed aboard an oil tanker bound for NATO forces across the Afghan frontier, and she reports on the dangers and daring involved in the trade.
On this stretch of highway on the outskirts of Karachi last week, bursts of automatic gunfire greeted trucks ferrying supplies to NATO troops across the Afghan frontier. Three people were wounded when militants on motorbikes ambushed the convoy. It was rare for Karachi. The majority of attacks have occurred closer to the Afghan border. 30-year-old Razik Shah grinds his tanker into gear. He's from the Northwest Hyber Agency, whose drivers dominate this dangerous business. Shah is carrying 10,000 gallons of fuel to troops next door, who consume more than 1 million gallons a day, according to NATO.
Here's my friend.
As Shah arranges himself for the long journey into Afghanistan, fellow travelers honk hello as they converge this sultry night on the Karachi port, where this odd fraternity begins its harrowing venture westward.
How many trips have you made to Afghanistan?
Afghanistan, takriban yari 200 trip na, 200 trip na bola gali.
You've made 100 trips to Afghanistan. Do you feel less secure each time? Do you feel that each time you've dodged a bullet? What does it feel like?
You would only go to Afghanistan if you didn't care about your life, or you were compelled to go to feed your family, Shah says. That compulsion gives us courage to do what we have to do. We have to fight the danger as well as poverty, he shouts above the din of the engine. Shah gestures with such excitement that half the time he's got no hands on the wheel. His fast-talking, manic demeanor marks him as a daredevil. He's had three brushes with the Taliban. Only luck and God have saved him, he says. Zayd Ullah Afridi is lucky too, but perhaps not as intrepid as the voluble Razik Shah. Back at the depot, Afridi sits shyly in a room full of drivers, many of them cousins. They importune him to tell his tale of why he no longer supplies U.S. and NATO troops next door. Four of us were taking oil to Helmand province when the Taliban appeared and ordered us out of the truck, Afridi says. Why are you coming here, they asked. We said we had to because there are no other jobs. They took our names and told us to take an oath not to come again to Afghanistan. We didn't swear an oath, but after that, Afridi says, I have never gone back. Zayd's cousin, Siraj Afridi, says he has no choice but to deliver supplies for a war he does not believe in, to combatants he does not support. He still drives across the border, despite coming under attack by the Taliban, who opened fire on his convoy as it snaked through a narrow canyon on the road to Kabul.
There was just 50 feet separating the mountain on each side, Siraj says. And when the Taliban started shooting from both sides, we abandoned our trucks and dove behind boulders. Three oil tankers exploded in flames, he says. Siraj says each member of his crew is gripped with fear. On the road, everything scares us. Trees, cats, goats. It's life and death. And we don't feel alive until we cross the border back into Pakistan, he says.
But Jacques Khalid, a senior officer of the Al-Haj group, a huge supplier to the U.S. Army and NATO, says 90% of his losses are in Pakistan. Khalid is an assumed name to protect his identity from those he says would stop at nothing to disrupt the supply chain into Afghanistan. Khalid says the company is losing an average of 3 tankers a month. Monthly profits range from $600,000 to over $2 million. A driver risking his life to supply troops in Afghanistan is paid just $300 for one trip that can last 15 days. But Khalid says this is not exploitation.
I'm not exploiting that subcontractor. That subcontractor have a certain driver. He has not put up a gun on his head that you have to go to Afghanistan. He is willing to do it for money.
Oil tanker owners have in the past threatened strikes to protest their lack of protection. The security of the supply lines will become even more crucial as some 30,000 additional troops pour into Afghanistan this year. But Khyber-based tanker owner Mohammed Shakir Afridi says as long as the Taliban fighters are willing to blow themselves up, no amount of security can stop them. Julie McCarthy, NPR News.
Poor mothers in Haiti have always been desperate to find a way to give their children a better life, in some cases even if that means giving them away. But the arrest of 10 American missionaries charged with trying to leave the country with 33 children has alarmed officials, who say child traffickers may take advantage of the chaotic post-earthquake environment. NPR's Juan Ferrero reports from Port-au-Prince.
The Plaza Saint-Pierre here has always been full of children playing. But not like this. In this tent village with hundreds of families, hungry, dirty, forced to relieve themselves in public, waiting for deliverance. Agnes Cherie has five children, and she says if she could, she would give them up for adoption. Standing next to her is her youngest, age 2, a boy suffering from a serious skin infection. She says she lost her house, her children are miserable, and she wants them to have a better life, like countless Haitian parents. Relief agency officials say it's not uncommon in Haiti for parents to abandon children or hand them over to a slew of orphanages, some of which are fly-by-night operations. That's helped spawn the trafficking of 2,000 children a year, some of whom are sexually exploited or put to work as servants. But with the earthquake, UNICEF's Roshan Kadivi says the problem is worse.
A lot of children have become unaccompanied. They have lost touch with family members. They have lost their homes. There is no school. So a lot of them obviously become victims for a lot of people who want to take advantage of them.
At the Children of Mary, Mother of the Divine Mercy, a spacious orphanage on a hill, children sing. Here, 24 children enjoy hot, healthy meals and a safe home. Unlike hundreds of thousands of children in Haiti, many of them newly orphaned or simply separated from their parents. Albert Silvera is the director, and she says families have come by to give away their children, but she says she has no more space.
They are looking for a better place for their children, especially that now that they have lost everything, because if not, those children will die, because they have no way to feed them.
Her orphanage is registered with the government. Others aren't, and Silvera worries that those may traffic in children.
You never know if some of those children are being taken for prostitution or for their organs. We have to watch out for that. And for many other things, we never know.
The government social service agency says it's inspecting orphanages. And relief agencies are helping President René Préval's government set up so-called children's brigades, special units designed to stop the smuggling of children at the border. The government did stop a group of Baptist church workers as they tried to go into the Dominican Republic with nearly 36 children, kids they said they were trying to rescue. But what the state can't do is create the kind of environment where parents wouldn't view giving away their children as an option. Island Nourmil says she has 4 kids and gave 3 away before the quake. One is in an orphanage. 2 others, handed over 5 years ago, are somewhere overseas, she says. She says some people blame her for what she did, but she says she simply couldn't feed or clothe them. She decided giving them away would give them a better life. Juan Ferrero, NPR News, Port-au-Prince.
Coming up, honoring the dead in Haiti, and an ABBA theme park opens in London.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the all-new MDX with super-handling all-wheel drive. More information is available at Acura.com.
This is Foreign Dispatch. I'm Douglas Roberts. The estimate of dead in Haiti has been put as high as 200,000. With most bodies hauled to mass graves or still entombed in destroyed buildings, normal funeral rituals are impossible. This in a country for which death requires an elaborate observance. NPR's John Burnett reports on how Haitians are coping.
All over Port-au-Prince, the places that normally play an integral role in burial customs are eerily empty. Mark Arthur Alcero, who runs two large mortuaries in the Haitian capital, is asked how many funerals he's had in the 16 days after the quake.
Very few of them, about eight or nine. That is very, very hard situation for a Haitian, for somebody, to know that his wife or his children is dead and he cannot find the body.
In one of the vast tent camps that fill every park, school ground, and open space, a man mashes boiled breadfruit into tom-tom, a stew made with okra that came from Africa during slavery times. Rosette Dabadzi sits quietly nearby, outside her tent made of bedsheets. She says her 22-year-old niece, Darlene, a college student, was crushed inside of her house. The body never recovered.
The only thing we have left is our memory. I know where she was when she died, but I know they'll take her body and put it in a mass grave, and I can't even go there to honor her, so it's difficult for us.
In any culture, it's painful to grieve for a lost loved one where there's no place to remember them. But in this Caribbean nation, so densely populated with spirits and the ceremonies that attend them, it's especially disruptive. In Haiti, the slaves that defeated the French and declared their independence in 1804 kept their African religion. Today, a majority of Haitians observe voodoo, a cosmic scheme whose fundamental principle is that everything, from humans to crocodiles to mango trees, has a spirit. Max Beauvoir is the Ati, the big tree of the Haitian voodoo religion. Wearing a tropical shirt, he sits in his garden at his house in Kurafor, which is outside the capital and escaped heavy damage. He's happy to explain what happens during a voodoo wake for the dead.
For 9 days, we grieve the person, meaning we invite the community to come around to celebrate the departure of the person. So in fact, people are gathered together night and days, and they eat and drink together, they chant, they pray, and the enemies are also invited as well. And all that bridges the wound that existed between families. And that's after those 9 days that we do the funeral.
The soul stays underwater for a year and a day, he says, after which another ceremony is held to pull the dead from the water. Then the reborn spirit goes to live in a big tree, a grotto, or some other place to await its reincarnation. Mimose Beaubrun, the musical partner of the Haitian roots musician Lolo Beaubrun, is a voodoo practitioner and researcher. She worries that with the sudden and violent deaths of so many, the living are unable to hold the normal ceremonies to help the spirits of the dead move on.
Normalement, l'homme on a mouri que faut que gain séparation parce que séparation l'esprit avec corps.
They have to make like a ceremony to help them, like the name is in Creole, desune, to let them go through it and accept that the spirit must get out of the body. So he say it's sad because right now, all those people that die, their spirit's still there in their bodies.
This is by no means Haiti's first mass calamity. Haitians have suffered repeated catastrophes, from hurricanes to earthquakes to massacres. Here, death is close at hand.
Baptisms I've done in the mountains for years. You look at that child's face, those eyes, 50% are dead by the age of 5 years old.
Reverend Stephen Davenport is a retired Episcopal priest from Maryland, rumpled with frizzy white hair. He's been coming to Haiti for 40 years.
Anybody here doesn't have a friend, member of the family, or whatever. They know somebody who died in this. And that's just a part of what they're going through. But, you know, never fear. They will not lose hope. They don't ever give up. It's incredible. Why? I don't know completely. I just learn from them, and if they don't, I don't.
Davenport is in Port-au-Prince helping his Haitian friends at St. Pierre Episcopal High School. The headmaster is Father Rival Lucas.
In our culture, people honor the dead. When they die,
They have a nice ceremony, a lot of services for them. To take all those bodies and put them in mass graves is not good. It's sad, shocking, and degrading. It disrespects the sacredness of a person.
Haiti's mass grave is located at the edge of the broken city, overlooking the shimmering bay of Port-au-Prince. At the foot of a treeless hillside where goats scavenge, a yellow excavator idles next to the fresh landfill within which rest countless nameless bodies. Inside the earth-moving equipment sits a stout woman named Esther. She doesn't want to give her last name. As an employee of Haiti's National Equipment Center, she's been out here every day since the earthquake digging the holes.
Esther, how many bodies do they think are buried out here? Any idea?
Esther says she doesn't know. She says the body trucks used to come all day long. Now only two or three a day come, and they're not full. They haul rubble that contains maybe four or five corpses. She sits here all day until quitting time at 6 o'clock, waiting for the body trucks. Sometimes people come to pray, and there are always a lot of journalists, she says with a slight sneer. She's asked what it's like for her doing this job.
I'm a human, and it affects me a lot, as everybody else. I have people that I know also that I lost, but somebody has to do the job. Like, we don't want the bodies to stay outside.
But there are many people that complain that mass graves are disrespectful of the dead, and there's got to be a better way to do this.
Yes, we know that it's so disrespectful since our tradition, it's not like that. But we have to take the bodies because we can't leave them on the streets.
The interview was cut short. A dump truck has just pulled off the highway and kicks up a cloud of white dust as it makes its way toward the gravesite. John Burnett, NPR News, Port-au-Prince.
If there's one 70s band that has managed to kick off its platform boots and transcend the era in which it was born, that band must be ABBA. The Swedish supergroup has sold some 400 million records worldwide, and as if the movie and the stage play of Mamma Mia were not enough to keep the ABBA flame alive for a new generation, there's now a whole new exhibition of their lives and their music, a theme park almost. It's called ABBA World, and it's not in Stockholm, it's in London. NPR's Rob Gifford went to take a look.
It's a mystery to some how the music of four small-town Swedes has managed to endure for nearly 40 years. But last week, two of them, Björn, the one who wasn't bearded but now is, and Annie Fried, the dark one, who's now blonde, turned up to officially open ABBA World, and they seem to like it.
It's very true to what we were, you know. It's quite moving as well.
And, you know, it's like looking in a photo book. You remember a lot of details that you have gotten, you know. So when you see the clothes, you know, where did we wear them, which TV show, yeah. Which tour.
Do you want it in Swedish or English?
I think I have it in English. My Swedish is a little bit rusty.
Oh, okay then.
The language options on the audio guide that you're offered give a hint of the smorgasbord of Swedishness that awaits you.
I alla visor och all poesi förälskar man sig om våren.
There are videos of the early days singing in Swedish and lots of high-tech interaction as well. Then, sure enough, there's a group of middle-aged Swedish ladies wandering through the exhibit, having the time of their lives. One of them is Ingrid Grandqvist, beside her friend Pia Lindqvist.
Very proud, we were touched by what they have achieved, and for themselves, but also for Sweden.
Do you kind of dance around the kitchen occasionally when you put on an ABBA song?
No.
No? Not really, no. They don't seem to know either why, since many years, Fernando hadn't held a rifle in his hand. Other questions emerge too as you wander through the exhibit, navigating between the gay anthems and the long-forgotten B-sides. Like, why did the song Bang a Boomerang never become a hit?
I'm just having a picture taken with them. Oh, I'm trying to fit myself in. I'll have to go this way.
The Beachy family is visiting from Essex. 11-year-old Hannah loves ABBA, and so does her 40-something father, Paul.
They're great.
Why? What do you like about them especially?
Because it's got girls and boys and they're singing. They've got like old-fashioned songs, but nowadays it's all like rapping.
Even better than rapping. There's a recommendation.
Although it is older music, I think it's still quite relevant to a lot of today's music. It doesn't sound out of place.
Organisers say the exhibit will likely go to New York next year and end up on permanent display in Stockholm. If you go, like the Swedish ladies visiting today, you too can dance up on stage with four holograms of the band members. What is it, a video?
A video.
So you're going to dance?
Yes.
And it films you, and what happens?
And then you can go into the website when you come home and look what you have done.
Fantastic. And show all your friends in Stockholm.
Yes.
That you danced with them at ABBA World.
Yes.
And there's the intro. I'll leave you to it. This is Rob Gifford, NPR News at ABBA World in London.
For more international coverage, you can listen to your local NPR station. You'll find a list at our website, npr.org. And while you're there, you can find more international stories by clicking on News and World. For NPR News, I'm Douglas Roberts. Friday night and the lights are low.